When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Welcome to a brand new edition of Freedom, Books, Flowers and the Moon, the podcast brought to you each week by the Times Literary Supplement. My name is Stig Abel, the editor of the TLS. Alongside me is commissioning editor and pronunciation guru Thea Leonard-Dutsey, although our new producer Matt is questioning you, Thea, as whether you are a pronunciation guru. Why?
Because I'm confused.
You're confused
by too many languages, and I quite often put the emphasis in the wrong part of the word.
It's just because you pronounce your name with such exuberant flourish, I think, that I've crowned you pronunciation guru. And you are very good at romance languages generally.
I would draw the line there,
yeah,
though.
I think sometimes
don't push me.
I think sometimes in the TLS we end up covering non-romance subjects, so we throw in a bit of German, a bit of Japanese maybe, and then you're kind of as clueless as me then.
Yeah.
Which is a heartening for me. So when we're talking about French and Italian, when we're talking about Italian, Elena Ferrante.
Elena, for a start,
Elena. I have to say, and now we're going to be talking about Elena Ferrante. And there's a pause, and then Thea talks about it, and you call her
Elena Ferrante.
Right, and I sound like a hick from the Midlands, which I am. I concede that point. But I don't think you're fully aware how culturally small you make me feel.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I know, it's all right. It's okay.
God.
We shall move on. Allow me to remind everyone, while I recover myself, that you can follow this podcast on Twitter at FBFM_podcast and review it on iTunes. And if you want to subscribe to the TLS, here is a deal for you. Google TLS subscriptions and type POD1 in the offer code section. You can get 6 issues for £6. Coming up on the show this week, we have an art history special in the paper covering such figures as Hogarth, William Morris, Tom Phillips, and those who resisted the rise of abstraction in the 20th century. But the lead is about a monumental book on two major figures of the early modern period, Hieronymus Bosch and Peter Bruegel. Are they okay?
I saw you roll the R there slightly. That was interesting.
Should I roll? How would you say Bruegel?
Bruegel, I don't know.
Well done. This book is by Joseph Kerner, has been reviewed by the magisterial Gabriel Josipovici, who will join us in a moment. I'm pressing on, Thea, we're not asking about that. We don't get proper bohemians these days, complains Libby Purvis in a review of the memoir of the extraordinary, and I do use the term advisedly, Amy Crocker, the San Franciscan heiress of the 19th century, who can really show us what true bohemianism, including assignations with snakes, a wild man of Borneo, and a feudal Chinese warlord, is all about. She, that is to say Libby, will be in the studio with us. And finally, we're publishing 5 new poems by the peerless Colm Toibin, who shall join us to read from them.
First up today, let's start with Oscar Wilde's truism, that life imitates art far more than art imitates life. If that's the case, then our subject's art education must differ wildly from most people's. I'd say Amy Crocker must have dropped acid and dashed through the Asian department of the V&A, or a blockbuster exhibition of the great surrealists, had she not been born in 1864. Crocker was the 6th child of an extremely wealthy San Francisco family. Her father was a judge and one of the big 4 railway investors. Her mother founded Sacramento's still celebrated Crocker Art Museum. But Amy had another life in mind, a life of adventure that would take her to India, China, New York, Paris, Hawaii, and all manner of places in between, where she hung about with our man Oscar Wilde and a litany of other wild men, women, and animals. Libby Purvis has reviewed a new edition of Crocker's memoir, first published in 1936 and called, provocatively enough, And I'd Do It Again. Libby joins us in the studio now. So, I mean, Libby, the book is, Crocker says, not to be taken as an apology, not at all. What would she have been expected to apologise for?
Oh, just about everything. I mean, making people faint at a New York dinner party in her old age by appearing in a revealing dress and a sort of rather exciting, sexually tight-wound live python round her body.
That'll do it.
Some people feel you should apologise for that.
I don't think you should, actually, now that you mention it.
Well, no, yeah, you don't. Obviously, yeah. You'd do it. And also for the travelling around the world and all the men and her absolute openness. we have to presume sexual openness to all manner of sort of wild men of Borneo and sort of random Indian gurus and Chinese philosophers and so on. She always had a husband, some kind of husband dragging along behind her, who seems to have had to just put up with it. And yes, so she was a shocking woman. But I think what's nice in the book is what comes off it is a sense of a proper bohemian. She was just doing her thing. She had unlimited money and she was just doing what she felt like. And she had enormous respect for the cultures of the places she went. There's a really interesting moment when she's in Hawaii with King Kalakaua doing the hula hula and dressing local. And she feels that sex is very natural and fine. And the local missionaries call her carnal and filthy. And she says, well, if by refusing to snub and patronise the natives we did them harm, I wonder how these good commercial men of God will answer one day for the land that they took away from the Kanakas.
Well, I mean, and in her politics, she's extremely enlightened in that sense, isn't she? She thought the British Raj was absurd.
Yes, she's very hard on the British Raj. And I have to say, I mean, I went on a holiday recently and I read an awful lot of Somerset Maugham for some reason, because it was kind of hot and there were crickets going at night and I just sort of felt like it. And I was just reading about all these colonial governors who were often about 19, you know, in remote islands. And, you know, there's one where they rush her away because she has basically, she's got the whole tribe, you know, she's fallen for the headman of the tribe. And the whole tribe is kind of saying you can't have a white woman and rushing her out. And you feel he just appears in passing, this poor local governor. But my goodness, the resident, you know, but he has to get her home. He has to get her out of his patch. She was clearly an absolute menace because she was very rich and very self-indulgent and did exactly what she wanted and never apologised for it.
And the world then was kind of large, wasn't it? I'm struck whenever you read books of Victorian adventures, they had a strange freedom to travel to places. They were discovering things, if not for the first time, for relatively recently otherwise discovered. And so they were having very fresh, very real experiences. And whenever you read these adventure tales, they sort of fill you with a sense of nostalgia for something you've never experienced and could never experience.
But, you know, quite a lot of those sort of, we say Victorian, but of course she was American, adventures of that period are a bit contemptuous. You know, they're a bit looking down on the poor fuzzy-wuzzy natives and so on. Rather like the all these Raj, sort of Somerset Maugham lot were. Yeah. And maybe it's because she's a woman. She absolutely doesn't. She's just totally open to them. She thinks they're all splendid, you know, and she falls for she falls for all sorts of people. She becomes a sort of prisoner of a warlord in China who says, I am the master of all that is beautiful in this house. I may keep these things, give them away or break them if it pleases me. And she has to escape in the middle of the night. And ends up having a sort of naked experience.
A naked orgasmic experience,
well,
you call
yes.
it, Libby, in the book. Let's not be coy about
Indeed.
This.
Indeed. Well, an old man plays a stringed instrument with rhythm after rhythm consuming her, and she faints dead away and comes round. You see, this is the thing. In the ladies' dressing room of an expat club with an Irish attendant holding smelling salts under my nose, I want the memoirs of this Irish attendant.
This stuff doesn't happen anymore, really. This is what I'm saying. The world has become very small and very sterile. And at this point,
everyone knows they're being watched at every moment.
Well, and also everybody wants to sell themselves at the time. I mean, she just had her circle of people, some of whom thought she was very shocking and others oiled up to her because she was rich when she did get back to America. But she just kind of got on with it. I mean, now, you know, there's an extraordinary bit where she goes to this party wrapped up in the boa constrictor she's borrowed off a friend. said, you know, the newspapers made the story into an orgy based on some vague idea of snake worship, which is very unkind.
But do you think she enjoyed the attention?
Of course she enjoyed the attention. She did it for attention, but, you know, she just sort of feels that it wasn't snake worship. She was just enjoying herself with her boa constrictor and her décolleté sequined dress.
Was she not restricted by being a woman at all? Is one of the liberating things about this, in a sense, that she is a woman at a time where there wasn't always a tremendous amount of liberation? She doesn't seem restricted by her gender at all.
If you were rich, I think you could pretty much do anything. There is a wonderful novel by that very, very underrated novelist, Laurie Graham, which was first called The Unfortunates and then later The Great Husband Hunt. And that is about an American heiress of exactly this period. You know, her father goes down on the Titanic and she inherits her money. And she just goes around doing what she likes. She actually ends up in Britain for a spell as well, you know, married to an aristocrat. And she learns to and she flies a plane.
Yeah.
You know, she learns to fly and just does it. I think if you were rich enough, you could just do anything. People will always oil up a bit to the rich and put up with a lot from them. But the thing is, she just did these things for the event, for the moment. Now you feel she'd have sold that party to Hello magazine.
Yeah, it'd be contrived now, wouldn't it?
Yeah, and it would be all commented on in the tabloids and so on. But she was just a wealthy hedonist, but she had these saving sort of proto-PC views which respected every culture she went into. And, you know, thought it was interesting and exotic and liked some people in it and disliked others. And the one person she's really vile to, I think I should mention this in your presence, Stig, as an Englishman. There's a handsome Englishman called Huntingdon Mear.
Good name.
Why are British persons of a certain class always so embarrassed and pink? And he gets annoyed. He gets annoyed because she falls for Baron Takamine, who eventually kills himself because somebody else rejects him.
There are lots of suicides and executions.
Totally, absolutely. Yeah. Constantly. And one man who has a very odd death in which he hypnotises himself into a cataleptic trance and gets accidentally autopsied while he's still alive. That happens.
You're like a kind of Nabokov in this review, actually. You just offhand kill people off. You know, this poor Baron, Miss Darnley, who turns him down and provokes ritual suicide, you say coldly, Libby. Just there he is, dispatched in four words,
well,
ritual suicide.
It's because Aimee, my new heroine in life, she moves on. And she doesn't like people who grumble. There's a wonderful thing about this Englishman when she snarls, I do not believe there is a woman alive or ever has been who can stand whimpering on the part of a full-grown man. Yeah. That's the Englishman.
Stop your whimpering.
They're either the
my
Raj...
My wife would agree with that.
They're either the Raj or they whimper.
They whimper,
I mean, this is a, you know, she's remarkable because she's not a stylist, but she's very, very straightforward. She just tells it as it is, or as it possibly was.
Well, I mean,
she clearly embroiders.
And it would be remiss to say, it wasn't all hijinks and fun adventure, because, I mean, her child was her. She lost custody of her first child.
She doesn't mention that at all. I think there's half a line.
She's got no space for the dark times.
There was a gigantic row over her husband. You know, who there was a breakup with her husband, and he got custody of the child, which was disgraceful, and so on. And she just sort of set off across the world. She doesn't bother with the dark side, unless of course it's other people's dark sides being autopsied while they're alive, or whatever. She just feels that it's a. She's on the side of the louche, and there's a lovely moment with Oscar Wilde where she has a drinking game with him. She says, I'm aware of the gigantic structure of naughtiness which the world has hung around the neck of his memory. This is in 1936, but she thought he was charming, if rather prone to dominating the conversation.
Which I'm sure that's what it
takes one to know one.
What is this slightly wrong, you can tell me this is completely untrue because the morality is different. This reminds me of a Flashman novel in the sense of, you know, sort of careening round the various exotic locations, getting into hijinks and sexual adventures. But of course, in the end, she is on the side of the angels because she regards people as people. She sees people as just who they are rather than what race they are, what class they are, which is kind of the opposite of what Flashman does.
And one thing we should mention is that she is accustomed to being very rich, and she's horrified when there's a clampdown, World War One, and the dollar. Suddenly you're not allowed to get dollars from America. And so she has to travel back on the ship. It looks as if she's going to have to travel steerage like any immigrant woman. And she really thinks it's terrible, and the newspapers will crucify her if it's discovered she's travelled as an immigrant woman. So she bribes one of the officers to give up his bunk. And then she has another sort of weird little quasi-sexual adventure on board with a chap who embraces her. And her main fear is that he would feel her various ropes of pearls and jewels she's hung round her neck.
And this is the only...
he presses himself against her.
This is the only way in which the First World War intrudes on her life.
Well,
this is the only mention she makes.
Why would it?
So she's a bit of a snob. She's not a snob.
I wouldn't say she was a snob. I think she's a bit... She doesn't like the idea of the newspapers mocking her, but she mixes with all sorts. I mean, she does rather prefer them to be sort of Japanese barons or very senior and important Chinese warlords. The Chinese warlord is the one seriously frightening bit where you think actually she might have not got out again.
She talks about watching death by a thousand cuts, which is presumably one of the worst things anyone could ever really see.
And then someone throws a knife and stabs her dressing gown as it lies on the bed, you see, and she could have been in that, but she wasn't. She gets out and...
Does she play down the seriousness of incidents for the sake of the narrative? I mean, I'm struck by, you say she's no stylist, but... And you feel she's embroidering it. I mean, are there moments where you think she's just playing up for the cameras, as it were?
I think a bit, yes. But, I mean, there has to be a core of truth in all of this. And, I mean, the core itself is mind-boggling enough. And I don't really care if it's true or not. You know, you might feel this is someone's made up. Yeah. You know, you might think, I wondered at first, is this a fake?
Yeah.
And then I sort of looked her up, and actually it doesn't seem to be at all a fake. And I think, in a way, the book doesn't read like a fake, because there's lots of bits which, you know, a writer would embroider.
Yeah.
You know, and she just says, and, you know, and so I went, you know, and so I went. And sort of just nice little grace notes, like when she hires a schooner, charters a schooner to go to the islands, you know, when she's off to Hawaii on the first leg of her big voyage. And the skipper says to her, as long as you're not a missionary, I'm not having any more missionaries. And she agrees that she's absolutely not
Amen
a missionary.
To that, yeah.
Huge disapproval of missionaries. I mean, she feels that they were venal and they were oppressive, and she's very anti-religion. And again, if you're rich enough, you can get away with that.
And how did her story end? Because obviously this is a memoir written in 1936, and she was 77, had 5 years left to live. How does her story end?
That I only know by looking her up, literally, on the internet. I think she just faded. She died. I mean, nothing very dramatic happened. It wasn't a python or anything like that. But
it's a shame that she didn't have an end that meets the rest of her life.
You know, she was... I like the idea of her sitting there in 1936, and just writing it all down.
Yeah.
You know, this has been my life. Clearly her friends would have encouraged her like mad. By that time, she's being a sort of New York or San Francisco socialite again. You know, she's just giving big parties and the travelling is over.
Was she a big was she a big name in her time? Because I've never heard of her.
The scandal. She was a big name, apparently, during the big scandal with her husband. And, you know, I think she was probably a sort of socialite name. I haven't been able to find very many writings about her, but that's just because that kind of writing is not so easily accessible, you know, unless you go to London Library and truffle around.
It's probably wrong in some senses, but you do have a sense of the era, don't you? That ability when, you know, for that fantastic wealth made you so much above ordinary experience. See, fantastic wealth now, I suspect, must be incredible, but it doesn't remove you so much from the ordinary run of things it must have done when you're a millionaire in 1900. You really were a millionaire and your life was completely removed from everyone else's.
And I think you also felt that there was a... you could go out into a sort of lawless world, you know, and you could, if you had enough money and bribed a few of the right people when you arrived and got the most comfortable place, you know, probably it was somebody else shuffling out of their palace for you, you were fine.
You had a sense of entitlement.
Yes.
I wonder if that sense of entitlement has gone. And there's a downside to that as well.
I would say not.
Do you think not?
I would say not. I think all these sort of...
Really?
But it's so dreary now. You know, these kind of Justin Bieber's kind of going around failing to get monkeys across borders and so on.
she would never have failed to get her monkey across the border.
If she'd had a monkey, they'd have had no chance. She just brought it with her. There aren't very many other animals, and it's mainly the python who sort of struck me firmly.
I get the sense you'd like to have lunch with this woman.
Well, she wouldn't let you go. I mean, I think I say in the review that reading this book is like being plied with cocktails by somebody who is determined you are not going to get home, you are not going to get onto your next appointment, you are going to go on and on listening to her, like Scheherazade, while she does multicoloured cocktails at you. And as I think I say at the end, I just kind of collapsed into the new Joanna Trollope novel. You know, so I thought, gosh, the things women make a fuss about these days are really quite small, aren't they?
Well, on that note, it's a wonderful review. I'm so glad we gave this book to you, because you really do... There's a bit of a kindred spirit there. Is that fair to say?
Oh, no, I'm a wuss.
I'm a wuss.
I'm in a Joanna Trollope novel. That's the horror of it all. I'm on Radio 4, God help us.
But you've basically... I think you've done Amy Cocker proud. It's a lovely book. Thank you so much for joining us. We have a major piece on two significant painters this week. Hieronymus Bosch, born around 1450, dying in 1516, was a Dutch painter whose religious works, the greatest of which are triptychs like the Heywijn or Garden of Earthly Delights, seems oddly to have increased in popularity in modern times, despite standing, to some minds at least, as a representation of a very medieval, very orthodox perspective of heaven and hell. Peter Bruegel, born somewhere around 1525, dying in 1569, is regarded by many as the most significant artist of the next period, the Dutch Renaissance. He painted landscapes and peasant scenes, even when he took on grander subjects like the fall of Icarus. I still remember seeing a copy of that painting for the first time, its extraordinary sense of perspective, where the body of Icarus is just the tiny splash of water in the corner, a few feathers floating above it, studiously ignored by the agricultural labourers who are the painting's main focus. It was, of course, described in a poem by W. H. Auden. Joseph Koerner has written a massive magisterial work linking the two men together, Bosch and Bruegel, from enemy painting to everyday life. The book is, according to Gabriel Giosipovici, an event, a magnificent achievement, which we will be returning to and arguing with for many years to come. Gabriel joins Thea and me now. Before we get to some moments you disagree with Koerner, perhaps you might explain why this is such an important book. So I got the feeling that although you had some, not quite complaints, but you had some arguments with it, you feel this is a significant and important thing.
Well, I've always liked Koerner's work. I thought that the opening and everything he says about Bruegel is terrific, because he's able to enter a painting and, you know, not just enthuse about it, but enthuse about it, you know, with a purpose. He sort of has a sense of where it's going, and he has the language and the ability, first of all, to express what he sees, but then to take us in with him into what the painting is doing to us as viewers as we are watching it.
I mean, you say in the review, I thought it's very striking that he has an ability to look and to find words for what he's looking at that set him in the very front rank of art historians. And I don't know whether this is naive, but that to me would be a prerequisite in writing about art, isn't it? That you can look at something and find appropriate words for it. Is that not as common as I might believe?
Well, it's common. You find the words, but, you know, you have to be a stylist and you have to just have a greater sense of purpose about what you're doing. I think this is what's special, that, you know, he doesn't just describe it, but because he's entered into it with empathy, he's able to lead us with him.
And to come to the central thesis of Koerner's book, how does he link Bruegel and Bosch? How does he bring the two together?
Well, this is where I began to have slight worries. I found the title a little strange, because he's a man, as I said, with a very, very sensitive ear. He writes extremely well. But I found that the subtitle, he calls it Bosch and Bruegel, From Enemy Painting to Everyday Life. Now, I'd never come across this term, enemy painting, and I think it's something he invents. But the thesis itself is extremely simple, and it's an old-fashioned thing that Bosch is medieval and Bruegel is Renaissance.
Yeah. And you don't really buy that, do you?
Well, it's not my experience of it. I can see that there are big differences between them. I can see that Bosch is clearly much more religious, but it seems to me that both of them move and interest me because of the way that the painting covers the overall surface. Something is going on, rather than everything being geared towards a central event. Everything is sort of spread out on the canvas. Koerner's argument is medieval, he is dark, his paintings are about the repression of the church and the pathetic nature of a befuddled humanity taken in by the devil, and this is what Bosch paints. Whereas Bruegel is all about Renaissance, freedom, realism, etc. You know, it's something that was already there in Burckhardt, in all the 19th century debates about the Renaissance. And it seems to me it's a very simplified view of the Renaissance as opposed to the Middle Ages, which so much work in the last 100 years has eroded, if not completely overturned.
And when you're discussing how your interpretation of Bosch's The Garden of Earthly Delights, that triptych there, that's where the difference in your interpretation and Koerner's really comes to the fore, because you're essentially saying that you see a multiplicity of equal events as opposed to one overarching grand narrative.
Yes. I mean, he's very good with Bosch at showing how these triptychs, of course, as used to happen in the Middle Ages, you get this in so many late medieval and Renaissance works, the two outer leaves folded over and a different image emerged when you saw it closed. On the closed surface of the Heywain, you have a pilgrim, or you have a figure crossing a bridge and going on. And he sees this entirely in terms of it is under the sign of a cross, which you can see at the back of the painting, And then everything in the painting itself is absolutely determined by this God who is looking down at this benighted humanity. And in the Garden of Earthly Delight, he reads every little bit of it as a kind of terrible, dark and repressive thing which Bosch is somehow creating in order to almost to entrap us, hence enemy painting. You know, it becomes our enemy as we watch it.
Is it not inevitable, and this is true, I think, of literature arguably as much as painting, that when you have close readings, you end up with closed readings? Because he's looking so intently to form a narrative that in doing so, he refuses to allow the notion of multiplicity and variation and other interpretations, because he's so closely linking himself to the painting, he's come up with a thesis that he feels he has to defend at all points.
But you could say just the opposite. You say if you look very, very closely at individual things, you can see all the multiplicity. It's when you start to stand back a little bit and say, now what's the historical argument, that you then oversimplify a historical pattern. And I think this infects even, you began by talking about the Icarus. It infects even his reading of Bruegel, which I think is wonderful all the way through. I think it's absolutely terrific. But I didn't have time in my review to talk about Icarus, that beautiful painting in Brussels that Auden wrote a wonderful poem about. Can I just read you the poem to remind you of what Auden says? So it's very, very famous, and Auden liked the idea that the first two letters were A and B, so whenever there was an anthology of his that was alphabetical, it was always came at the beginning.
Yeah, that's very good.
And I always have in my head his way of, and I couldn't possibly read it, but anyhow, about suffering they were never wrong, the old masters. How well they understood its human position, how it takes place while someone else is eating or opening a window or just walking dully along. How, when the aged are reverently, passionately waiting for the miraculous birth, there always must be children who did not specially want it to happen, skating on a pond at the edge of the wood. They never forgot that even the dreadful martyrdom must run its course, anyhow in a corner, some untidy spot, where the dogs go on with their doggy life and the torturous horse scratches its innocent behind on a tree. In Bruegel's Icarus, for instance, how everything turns away quite leisurely from the disaster. The ploughman may have heard the splash, the forsaken cry, but for him it was not an important failure. The sun shone as it had to on the white legs disappearing into the green water, and the expensive, delicate ship that must have seen something amazing, a boy falling out of the sky, had somewhere to get to and sailed calmly on. Now, Körner makes a very good point that the middle bit is concerned with another painting about the torches and the horses rubbing the innocent behind on the tree. And he says, these are Auden skaters on a pond at the edge of the wood. Why, according to the poem, must they always be there? Because, blissfully and cruelly self-absorbed in their play, children stand for indifference as the inborn and perennial position of the human species. You know, indifference is a very loaded word.
Mm.
And it seems to me it is sort of saying God is indifferent, the world is indifferent to man, this is a tragedy. Whereas I think both Auden and the painting have something that's more like, I don't know, Homer or Sophocles saying, in the world, many, many different things are going on. We have to accept that.
It's kind of it's heartening, isn't it, I think? That,
well, there's sort of playfulness about it as well.
Yes, and as you mentioned it, Stig, right at the beginning, you know, there is something sort of wonderfully heartening, wonderfully warm and playful. And I think Bruegel catches this. And to narrow it down to the world's indifference or heaven's indifference to man, I think limits it. I think whenever Körner deals with these larger cultural issues, I feel that something slightly coarser enters into the writing and the thinking.
If someone listening to this, you can direct them to go and see one painting, Bruegel or Bosch, because the great thing about the world now is they're so accessible, people can go and look at them. What would you direct them to? You've only got one. You can maybe have one for each artist if you're lucky.
I think look at the Garden of Earthly Delights, which is such a mysterious and strange painting, and I don't think susceptible to any kind of single interpretation, the Bosch. And Bruegel, I do think that Hunters in the Snow is just absolutely wonderful, and you see it on the covers of so many books.
And Christmas cards, weirdly.
And Christmas cards, but actually cropped, and you need to see it all.
Exactly.
And Kona is wonderful at exploring just how our eye is taken into this whole strange white landscape, but he's very good generally on snow in Bruegel.
Well, listen, your joy in these paintings comes across very loud as well, Gabriel, so thank you very much for joining us today.
Not at all. I look forward to the issue. Thank you.
Thank you.
Cheers.
When you talk to someone who really does love what they write about, you can sense this in this. Well, I think it's very nice for Joseph Koerner is someone has taken 4,000 words, probably 1,000 of which are quotations of him.
Mm.
He's taken him really seriously. He's taken the paintings really seriously. And it does make you go and want to look at him. Now, I could spend, I lost about an hour looking at Bruegel paintings, having read this review.
And it wasn't lost.
No,
it was gained.
But I do think people, one of the things, because we've tried to do as many pictures as we can, we've got three big pictures. So one of the problems sometimes when you read about paintings, if they're not in front of you, it's quite hard to engage. And I think what's good about this is it might, makes you go and look at a painting.
Well, also what's so interesting about, because there are such extended quotations there in Gabriel's piece of Koerner's writing, you can see how immensely detailed it is and this unrivaled, well, perhaps not unrivaled, but certainly very acute eye for detail and the story behind the detail. And he takes you, kind of takes you step by step through the narrative and what will happen next. And, you know, the peasant will, you know, if you look down, you'll see that he's about to stumble into a river and, you know, the hat is about to fall and you're drawn into the narrative.
I just assume that most art historical writing of quality would do this, but maybe it's not as common as I might think, the ability to write about a painting in a way that makes you see it.
I'm sure a lot of the time it will be what we were talking about, though, where the thesis kind of bullies the joy of the writing, of the painting, the description out of the way.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Let us speak to Colm Toibín, the great Irish writer whose novels include The Testament of Mary, The Heather Blazing and The Master, which is my favourite, telling as it does the story of the life of Henry James. Colm is, of course, also a notable poet, and we're delighted to be publishing 5 new poems in the TLS this week, a couple of which touch upon our overarching theme of art. The torturer's art begins with this line, like many torturers who came before, the art he favours has a hint of risk, and tells the tale of the guests milling about the torturer's home, looking at the paintings on the wall, while their host smiles and caters for our needs. Colm joins us now. Colm, before we hear the poems, perhaps you might tell us how poetry fits into your writing schedule. Can you do it while you're working on a novel, or do you need to separate it out?
It often comes when I least expect it. There was a good period when I didn't write any poems at all, and then in the wake of writing The Master, when I suddenly had no novel to write, just images would come and I would note them down, and then there's an awful lot of erasure. They're usually much longer. And then eventually they get down to something. You know, I work on them every so often. I just take them out again and think, Is there anything more could go in this?
certainly a couple of the ones you're going to read for us now sound like they were written perhaps on the same. I sort of have an image of you wandering through an art gallery, possibly in Spain, notepad in hand.
No, it would be late at night with the image coming and then making it far too long and over a few months.
Well, Miró certainly isn't far too long. It's very, very short. Yeah. I love that poem.
The torturer's art struck me as a bit sort of a dramatic monologue in some sense. What's the thinking behind that?
I better not say what country it is, but there is one country in South America where I was actually found myself in somebody's house, and I realized that this was the person who had personally tortured people, and but he was the host that evening. And what was notable, I mean, was the art on the walls and how genial generally he was. And so that poem arises very much from being the guest.
It reminded me a bit of sort of Coetzee in some ways, you know, that's the civilized front behind which lurks things that are rather terrible.
Yes, and the art being a dead giveaway, you know. I mean, there was no Mondrian there. It was an awful lot of squiggles.
And you thought that was indicative of what lurked beneath?
Well, I tried to connect the two, you know, between the sort of... There was an element of just of the art being overdone.
Making up for something, was it, perhaps?
Yeah.
What else are you working on at the moment, Colin? What are you doing at the moment?
I have a novel coming out in May called House of Names, which is a version, I suppose, of the story... Well, no, it is a version of the story of Clytemnestra and Agamemnon and Orestes and Electra.
Oh, amazing. But not presumably set in those times.
Oh, yeah, and set in those times.
Is it?
Yeah, it's not a contemporary telling. It's set in those times, yeah.
And how have you found doing that, sort of writing that sort of historical fiction?
The figure that began to obsess me was Orestes, because he doesn't get to speak much in the Oresteia or in any of the other versions. Whereas we hear from Clytemnestra, especially in the Euripides, Iphigenia ad Aulis, and we hear a lot from Electra in the various versions, but Orestes is often missing and then just comes back and is sort of used to basically to kill his mother. And we hear from Agamemnon, but so it's the boy that I began to see, well, where was he before he came back? And also to try and get a version that's credible for a novel reader of the lead-up to somebody killing the mother and the aftermath, so the Furies, the element of the Furies in the last part of the Oresteia has to be psychologically credible.
So you're kind of injecting a bit of realism into what can feel quite ritualized.
Yeah, I mean, that was the aim, to actually take out a lot of the Furies and the gods and bring it down to dry land and see where it would take me.
Because in some senses, I suppose, Orestes is the victim of fate. He feels like he's very pliable. Things are always happening to him, and then he actually commits an act of ultimate agency. But before that, he's very much sort of pushed around by forces that are stronger than him.
Yeah, and that's what fascinated me, that he's the passive one. He's the younger brother. He's the one that Electra can tell what to do. So therefore, from his side of the thing, what's that like?
Oh, wonderful. We look very much forward to reading that column. Thank you so much for doing this. We'll be over to you in a second to hear these five poems that we are publishing in the TLS this week. So to end the show, we're going to hear this poetry now by Colm Tóibín, read by the poet himself. And until next week from Thea and from me, goodbye, but over to you, Colm.
Miró. He responded to the picture's need as a parent to a child's cry, or a bird in the air to a worm or a fly. In San Clemente, dripping water and the smell of darkness, this is where I will go. Follow me now. Time pressed down, led down, down as the steps lead down. I will go into the dark without you. Below this below there is more, and it is below that I belong to. Don't follow me further. Move away. Don't follow me further. Lost for words. The sea is all washed up, the house rocks on through the night, nothing will see reason. Most things have left us, and some people too. Strange the speed with which they disappeared. And colours died that gave a shape to things. Just what is lost comes vaguely in these dreams. And the dead sad words float out in foolish space and have the weight of atoms in a wind. They do not want to come to earth again. I saw their tears unflowing in the sky. In an old house, I heard some words for flowers, buttercup, lupin, truth, and fleur-de-lis. And there were names for trees, bark brown, oak, and hard. The loveliest of all, they said, easy to live with, and soft on the eye. On a saint's day, you climbed into its soul. Face. Drawn chalk yellow out of dust, keeping us free from sin. There are shadows, sublime inventions, while I listen and say that I too have seen visions. The skin crack, the dried up fist banging helplessly on a shut door. Locked hollow spaces left there after the war. The torturer's art. Like many torturers who came before, the art he favours has a hint of risk. A naked bottom, some cubist forms, but more unwieldy, more Picasso than Juan Gris. Under the sweetness of his homely gaze, I move from piece to piece and note the mess of squiggles, the maze of marks and dots, a wildness in the paint, a love of gesture filling every space, nothing white, nothing withheld or pale. The lopsided look of one depicted face suggests the torturer's at home with pain, or wants it just enough to make its mark. In his house, as guests, we mill about. He dealt with those he set out to defeat. Freed, he smiles and caters for our needs.